Hey, I'm Daniel Colburn.
I'm Caleb Porzio.
Welcome to 20% Time, where two coworkers discuss one programming topic per week for an average of 33.2 minutes.
That was like a very like limp clap on my end.
Limp in what way?
I expected like a more sonorous clap. And it ended up being like very like bah, bah. Like I was going for like a pa.
Right. But no, mine was crisp. It was a crisp clap for sure.
Mine was like it sounded like I like slapped a wet fish down on the counter.
Speaking of wet fish.
Oh, seriously, I can't though. I can't wait to see where he takes this one.
So I am eating wet fish right now.
What? Ew.
I want to tell you about this on the show. Because it actually is a tech thing. So I'm eating a can of sardines. Straight up sardines with skin and vertebrae. And you get them at Aldi for pretty cheap. Mm-hmm. And you get the sardines in the spring water, not the cottonseed oil, in case you're wondering. Mm-hmm. So I got the sardines. Mm-hmm. Got to get them omega-3s, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I've been chasing this omega-3 thing for a while, and fish is a great way to get it. And so I got turned on to canned fish, and it's been this whole process of wading into the world of canned fish because it's pretty much disgusting. And you have to start small with something tasty like smoked mackerel.
Just eat fresh fish.
And then...
Why do you insist on eating canned fish? Why don't you just eat real fish?
You could, but it's an easy way to just, you know, get a hit of omega-3s, you know?
You have to eat a meal anyway. Why don't you just make that meal be
fish?
See,
that's the thing. We just hung up, and I had 5 minutes, and I was like, look, I'm like, what am I going to eat that's going to sustain? I got some almonds.
How many individual fishes did you consume in the last 5 minutes?
Three.
Three whole fishes.
But these ones don't have heads. Often they have heads. And that is... For real. Yeah. So, okay. So I am eating sardines. And the vertebrae is the hard part to get over. Because you actually... Like, it crunches. And it's that's tough.
No
and you
problem.
Can see
no problem.
The vertebrae in the center of the fish as you, like, break it in half. So... Anyway, I'll save that part of it. I'll spare the listener. But basically, so the sardines I bought, these Aldi sardines, bought them, looked at the can, was like, okay, what's my omega-3 thing here? Didn't say. Uh-huh. It didn't say, like, how much omega-3s. Most of these cans say, like, you know, 1,300 millifrugals or something. And so, anyway.
Sure.
Right. This can didn't have it, so I thought, okay, well, this is the package it came in. Like, doesn't it have to have it? And I was like, come on. So I looked online, eventually found my way to the USDA database for all food. And yeah,
okay.
So there's this website on the USDA website that you can go to, and you can search their database.
Oh, I see where this is going. You built an SDK for the USDA.
Boom. Food. So I didn't actually build an SDK. I did something, I think, kind of cooler. Well, just different.
Okay.
So I was on the USDA website, found out that all the world's food is stored in this database, and you can get unlimited information about the food, nutrition, everything. It's ridiculous.
I think there may be a theoretical limit, but go on.
No limit. And so you can actually sort by manufacturer. So you can sort by Aldi and find everything at Aldi. And as a frugal person, I'm like, okay. This is unlocked the key to life. Like, I will now automate my health as well as my finances by just like running reports, sorting by omega-3s, and make like a calculation. So anyway, but so I had all these thoughts, and I was like, okay, step one is getting a hold of this database. Like, I need this database locally. How do I do that? And so like they actually do have an API, and you sign up for it and you get a key, but it's kind of slow. And there's a limit on the amount of results. It's like 50 results.
Wait. I was led to believe that it was unlimited data.
It is. just over time. So yeah, so you get 50, you know, it's paginated and it forces like a whatever. So anyway, I'm thinking like, okay, I want to get this in a Mongo database. Like I want to get some sort of NoSQL database.
Whoa, SQL.
Yep. So I was like, all right, do I do Elasticsearch? Do I do Mongo, Couch? I didn't know what to do. I've used Mongo before. I already had it. So I did Mongo, whatever. And
yep, done it.
So I was like, this will be so easy. I'll just make this thing that, but then I'm like, wait, I'm going to be looping over this paginated result set of all food in the world. and it's going to, you know, whatever. So then I was like, aha, what if I made them as jobs and queued them with Horizon? Because you can do that, like, you know, multiple threading job working listening thing with prioritizing and stuff like that. So what if I made a job for, you know, downloading these results and I made some sort of like each job contained what paginate offset it needed. And I just fired off like thousands of jobs and then ran a ton of threads, or I don't even know what they're called, processes, listener processes. And just started cranking through this API in parallel, putting it into Mongo.
So I did it. Did you do that?
It did. Yeah, it took me like a day to do it all.
Do you have any sort of intelligence that knows when it gets like a you've exceeded your limit thing and then stores its place and then tries again later?
Right. So no. So what
I do... So how do you know you're not losing data when you hit your API
limit? All the jobs start failing. And then I stop the queue. I wipe out the whole Redis queue. And then I look in Mongo for the last ID, and then I just pick up from there. So super manual, not cool. If I, you know, I should have done, but I was like, no, I'm just, this is a one-time deal, so.
So how many foods do you have now?
Oh, like 400-something thousand, I think.
That's a lot of foods.
It's a lot of foods. And you can search, well, yeah, so you can do so many things, and it because it gives you way more than just the nutrition facts. It gives you, like, all the vitamins and minerals. It gives you, like, it links to, like, research papers on the foods.
Would you argue that vitamins and minerals are not nutrition facts?
They are, but it goes in more depth. Like, you don't get omega-3 content on a nutrition label, to my knowledge.
Sure.
You know? Or omega-6s. Stuff like
that.
So it
just gives you, like, a superset of the back of the can nutrition facts.
Yeah, way more super setty, and it and you have ingredients and everything. So like, you could potentially do all these crazy things where like I have my Aldi food database. Then I like break each food down. I do like analysis of each food by the ingredients and follow like list of ingredients and find those foods and reference them. I don't know. There's so many possibilities. So
sure.
Anyway, super exciting. A friend of mine actually runs a site called FoodTruth.net. And he does the same thing with the USDA database, but he compares food. It's fun. I don't know, whatever. He's a paleo guy, if anybody likes that stuff.
Does he already have a copy of the database?
Yeah, so that, right. He just told me a long time ago, he goes like, oh yeah, I just like pull on the, you know, insert acronym here database. And I was like, whoa, he's like crazy. He's got some access to something. I just wrote it off. And then basically like I made my way pretty far into the process before I realized, oh, he probably does the same thing. He probably did the exact same thing I'm doing right now. So, yeah, he must. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a thing that you could do.
Okay.
You know schema.org?
No.
So it's like Google's project to create a schema for all things.
Yeah. Yep, I remember that.
And well, it's not just Google. Google is like one of the main people involved, but I think Facebook's involved and everything like that. So I have had this theory for a long time. Well, that we talked about this, the like Amazon Echo, app generation episode
where you just command the app to make an app or command, and it uses
schema.org to like come up with all of the data and blah, blah, blah.
Yep. Right.
Anyway, you could theoretically, based on the name of the things, look up like schema.org information on those things. And the cool thing about it is because it's all like extendy, like you could categorize all of those things using schema.org. So for example, like sardine, like I'm sure there's a schema.org entry for sardine and it's a subset, or it extends fish.
Right.
Which extends, you know.
True.
Right. And like, I'm sure there's a way that you could like create some sort of a database schema just by like looking stuff up.
Let's do it.
Anyway, that's all.
Let's do it.
That's all I have. And then, neural nets too, but we'll talk about that another time. You could do neural nets.
What are neural nets?
A neural network where you like give it a bunch of, like your brain is a neural network, but no, you know, neural networks, like that's how they do everything. Like, analysis of large sets of data. You don't know about neural networks? Okay.
Nope.
So a neural network, basically, a really simple example is like face recognition. So I built my goal was to build a face recognition doorbell, for my house.
Wow.
But I couldn't find like a good lock to control for like less than $400.
Oh, really?
So I didn't do it. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
dude. But you like, make your own. I did. I have the things if you want them.
Cool.
The little,
we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
But anyway, so what this was it basically a webcam hooked up to a Raspberry Pi hooked up to a button.
Yep.
And you pressed a button, the webcam took a picture of your face, and then I had used this face detection library, which is basically a neural network, where you feed it like 400 images of people who aren't you.
Okay.
And then like 30 or 40 images of you.
Okay.
And you say, these 30 or 40 images are me, and these 400 images aren't me.
Okay.
So now you know who I am. And then you can give it an image, and it will tell you very accurately whether it's you or not. And so the way neural networks work is basically like it's unclear exactly to me how they work. And I'm not like a data scientist, so I can't give you all of the cool info, but there are lots of packages where you can just pass it like a bunch of data. And if it's all structured similarly, you know, and just say like, these ones pass and these ones fail. And then like you can feed it random data and it will tell you whether it will pass or fail.
Yeah.
Like it creates all the rules for it.
Right. It's like machine learning.
Like machine learning. Exactly. And so you could create a neural network for example, say sardines you've now found to be like one of your key foods,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You've detected that based on all the data that sardines are like now one of your key foods.
Right.
So I would say like you could.
Oh, like based on ingredients and like nutrition facts and stuff.
Well, who knows what it's going to end up being based on, right? That's the cool thing about neural networks.
Right,
you have
right.
What
yep.
it's going to be based on, right?
Right,
but, like,
right.
you could just start, like, anytime you find, like, one of these key foods where you feel like you've, like, leveled up your food knowledge
yep.
by experiencing this food, you can just throw that into your neural network. And now that you have information about all foods, your neural network could just test all foods.
And just know.
And it could just be like, hey, have you considered... you know, like small baby
smoked
birds
oyster.
In a hen yeah. or whatever.
Oh, man.
Whatever's next.
Yeah, that would be something.
I'm just saying, like, if you're trying to, like, really discover the next food that's really going to be, like, the seaport's
right.
way of life food, I think using this
that's
database
not,
in a neural
actually,
network, you're going to generate your next food.
I love it. All right. Let's get it going. Get up and running.
Hashtag big data.
Big data. Yep.
Yep.
Yep,
yeah,
yep. 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 You know, there is a.
What is this
like,
episode about?
It's about machine learning.
Okay, cool. I don't know.
Amazon has a machine learning API.
They do.
Last company I was at, we like brainstormed all these ways to use it. I never wrote the code for it, but like, it's kind of cool. Like, at AWS Summit, like I went to this thing and they walked you through like the actual interface on AWS for machine learning. And it's actually like WYSIWYG, like not WYSIWYG. That's not the right word. It's just a GUI that you can just use the GUI interface and upload like an Excel spreadsheet. Like the example they did was Titanic survival, you know, just Titanic people, all the people on the Titanic. And they uploaded the spreadsheet and it had like their birth, their where they were born, their age, their... ethnicity, you know, when they died, how they died, you know, if they died or not, Boolean on the Titanic. And so they like uploaded the spreadsheet, like just like clicked upload on the spreadsheet. And then it gives you like all the fields and you can just change fields and it'll tell you like what, and then compare it against a field. And we compared it against death Boolean toggle on or off, uh-huh. and you could like basically predict if you would have died on the Titanic or not. You know.
Wow.
So we were just messing with numbers. That's like crazy. Straight up in a GUI interface on the AWS.
Would you have died on the Titanic?
I don't know if I did myself. Probably.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, right. I'm a guy, right? Don't guys definitely die?
Oh, because the women and children go first on the lifeboats?
Right. I'm pretty sure, like, I would have... Yeah, if you're a guy and if you're, like, you know, poor...
Well, okay, here's a question, right? Like, back then, there wasn't computer programming as a vocation, right?
Right.
So you probably would have ended up being a musician anyway. So you would have gone down with the ship and played the orchestra until the ship sank.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. Sorry, you're dead.
Shoot. So that's machine learning, which is cool. But yeah, there's an API that you can just, you know, I'm being silly and confusing machine learning with... what's that thing where you pay people pennies to do microtasks?
Mechanical Turk.
No, I did go to the machine learning thing at AWS. That all the stuff about the GUI is true. The fact that we wrote an API for it is false. We wrote an API to consume Mechanical Turk to process a ton of data. So, okay. That's that. Yep. Okay.
Content.
So this podcast is about... it is not about sardines or Horizon or parallel processes or NoSQL or machine learning or Mechanical Turk.
But it could be.
Or about baby birds and tins. Yeah. It's about Dusk and snapshot testing.
Okay. And before we get too into this... this is an example of your core competency, and I think the food database thing was a fitting companion to this topic, because your core competency is taking tools that Taylor makes as extensions of Laravel and then using them wrong in creative ways.
Using them in unethical ways, like the Southwest tracker.
Oh man, tell that story.
Where I learned all about ethics from Daniel because I made a South... Okay, Dusk, whatever. At Southwest, if you book a flight in Southwest and you can... If the flight is cheaper, you've already paid for the flight. If the flight goes any cheaper, you can harvest that like difference by just going on to Southwest and like... there's a button, like it's part of the UI. Like you can just whatever, like rebuy the flight and it'll refund you the difference, right? Uh-huh. And so that's a totally legal, legit thing to do. So me and my wife and her mom, like, we're all like clicking Southwest all the time to check these flights to harvest these little gains, because you never know when it'll drop, right? So I was like, this is a great thing for Dusk to just, you know, program like a list of flight numbers and then the threshold that I want to be text messaged when it reaches. And so I just made a little Dusk automation thing where it just has like a property in the Dusk test case that's like the flight number, the date, where it's from, and like the price I want to be texted at. And then like, you know, it just goes through, you pull the stuff out of the DOM, run through it, blah, 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 text with Twilio or whatever. I don't know, whatever the testing thing is, a texting thing I used.
It's Twilio. Yeah.
Is it Twilio? What's the other one? Is there another one?
Nexmo.
I used Nexmo. So, and then if it hits it, Nexmo just sends me a text. And then I was like, okay, I need to make this a service. I need to make a web app where people go on and they put in their, and they pay like per watcher. Like you pay like, I want a watcher for this flight, and it'll text you when you're ready to harvest some gains. So anyway, so I put it on the Titan Slack and was like, oh, I'm so proud of this. This is so cool. Like, this is a cool idea. Check out what I did. And then, and then people started saying like, they're like, questioning the ethics of it, like as Southwest does this for, you know, for like, because Southwest doing this is sort of like, they're expecting you not to hack it and make money off of it, you know, like that's, sure. Southwest is traditionally a cool company, and historically, and so they're cool to you, and their kind of promise is like, be cool to us, like, so anyway, we started having these ethical conversations, and then Dan...
Did I argue that point?
No, you were like... You argued utilitarianism, I think. I don't know which point you argued.
I don't think I argued a point. Right, I think I used it as an object lesson to get you to think about utilitarianism.
Exactly. And that I had never heard of utilitarianism. And I had never really had a real ethical discussion, like outside of just using my own brain to think about ethics. Like, I'd never pulled in like ethics as a branch of philosophy.
Right, as a formal existing thing.
Right. And so that was new for me. And that was really fun. And I never ended up making the app. But that's just because of laziness.
Because of laziness, right?
I want to say ethics, but you know what? What's is there a word for that when like your principles align with your laziness? Like, and
yeah, justification.
Okay, I mean, is there an actual word? Or
I mean,
it is justification, but okay.
I have no idea.
You know, like it's hard. Like, oh, I don't vote because you know I believe in this and this. Where like really,
it's kind of sandbagging. It's a version of sandbagging, I think.
Okay.
I need to look up sandbagging now. Anyway, introduce the topic while I look up sandbagging.
The topic is snapshot testing dusk. And dusk.
Yeah.
So right. So that was the dusk thing. So here's the deal. The problem is. We have a dusk acceptance test suite for this application, right? The application mm-hmm. is all microserviced out all over the place, but we sure. The dusk tests live on the part that has the front end code, right?
Sure.
So it's a Laravel app that serves some Vue stuff, and we have dusk tests that, you know, do stuff. So the tests, I was like, these tests give me assurance. They're end-to-end tests. I fill out a form, I hit save, I assert that I see the things on the next page and on the other pages, and I thought, this is end-to-end, and this gives me security about the application because the tests are lacking sort of deeper down the application and the microservices. So
yes,
so I had that assurance. Then we had a huge issue, and it lots of things blew up, and we were like, how did this slip by? And turns out my dusk tests did not catch a thing, and this is why. Because there was a service that basically a part of our application is an Elasticsearch, a NoSQL thing, right? So part of the application is a NoSQL thing that other applications call on, right?
Yes.
And so there's like a service that runs on a cron that populates that Elasticsearch database with stuff from our like normal like persistence database, right?
Yes.
And so the dusk test, all the data looks the same because it's just testing the UI, which is based on the persistence database. But in the meantime, part of our applications, really our application's interface to other areas of the system is this NoSQL database that gets sort of run on a cron. So anyway, there was a problem in the way that was being populated that the point is that my dusk tests, I realized that they need to test against this NoSQL database. Does that make sense? Because it's a part
yes,
of our application
yes,
that other outside of our wheelhouse things rely on.
Sure.
Right? So it is an end. Like we can't end-to-end test just with the UI. Because this is not
so many ends.
Because there's so many ends. Exactly. This is a third end. This is like end to end to end. You know.
And would you say that that justifies the means?
I never justify the means with the end.
What about if you had three
it's
ends?
All
would
means.
That justify the means?
Right. We need the ends to justify the means in this case. But I'm a means
yeah.
guy for the
well.
Record.
In this case, it sounds like the ends are justifying the means stack.
Yes, that well, one end is one end is the mean stack. Yeah.
Sorry, carry on.
Well played.
On.
That was
okay,
that
so
was
end
well
to end
played.
To end.
I like that. That was very very clever.
Thank you.
So, so
very
basically, there's the problem. What are your thoughts on it so far? Is this? What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are I understand that you have a problem. So you were testing this end to end testing, but you didn't consider that there was like another entry into your application.
Exactly. Yeah.
That wasn't just the front end code. Because you're used to dealing with these big monolith things where like
yeah.
the only thing that interacts with your app is the front end code. And maybe you have like a public API, but you just test that the easy way.
Right. Yep.
And so now you're having you've got this database, and this database is getting pulled from various places. that are not like in your direct control, and you don't know how to test it.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that was the problem. And so I got to talking with good old Keith.
He is good.
Keith the Sage. Keith is, was just, you know that term, but I didn't before my Wikipedia spree the other day. But it's like a stage of philosopher, like when you transcend philosophy and you don't need philosophy because you just hold the wisdom that philosophers love.
Are seeking,
right. You now have the wisdom and you are a sage.
Yeah. I'm very happy that you're going down this philosophy Wikipedia hole. At some point, you're going to transcend the 2 years worth of college knowledge that I have. It's going to be great. And then you can teach me about philosophy.
Solely by reading the first paragraph section, the intros on Wikipedia articles.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably all I remember. I wasn't paying attention very much in class. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, quick side note. Somebody on Twitter was like, posted this thing in reply to me when I showed them the Wikipedia thing that was like this phenomenon that all Wikipedia leads back to the philosophy Wikipedia article.
That is literally the whole point of why philosophers think they're better than everyone. And this was true before Wikipedia, but they basically were arguing that like everything is actually just philosophy, and like if you guys would just get that through your heads, we could have a much more productive discourse.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I that's sort of, well, yeah. So then I'm like, okay, well, is Wikipedia designed by, are the people who link it just philosophy minded who like create those links, or does all reality like go back to philosophy anyway? And Wikipedia is just an expression of that, you know?
Right. And what you didn't consider was that by even asking that question, you were doing philosophy. So it's right. So a moot point.
Oh, so good. Another side thing, have you ever played the Wikipedia game where you like you have to get from one place to another just by the links inside the article?
Oh, no. It's and you fun. See how few hops you can do it in?
Yeah. Yep.
Ooh, that's really good. All right, well, let's set up a challenge for the listeners right now, and then we'll elicit Twitter responses. Because everyone's got 280 characters now, so
that
should be pretty easy to explain your path. Where do we want to get from and to?
We want to get from,
Oh, well, here's an easy one. Let's get from test-driven development.
Great.
To philosophy.
Okay, great.
So you get, is there a test-driven development page?
There's gotta be.
Test-driven development Wikipedia.
I never search Wikipedia at the end because it's like always the first thing.
Test-driven development. There's a page.
Wait, can we go we'll start with this. It might be fun to go from test-driven development to like something back up the chain, but I like philosophy. We have to do philosophy.
Okay, well, this is a problem because on the page there is a link to list of software development philosophies.
Oh, no.
So that's going to be too easy.
Test-driven development to something super obscure but really like sardines.
Okay, sardines.
Yep.
All right. Test-driven development to sardines. And should we make a rule that you're not allowed to use the disambiguation thing at the top?
Let me see. What is the disambiguation thing at the top?
Well, you know, like if you type in something like,
or
no. That's fine. But like, imagine that I typed in.
Where it gives you the list of like alternate.
Like AC/DC, right?
Yeah, and it's like referring
disambiguation.
To like
did you mean like alternate current, direct current, or did you mean the band?
Yeah.
Like, I think that is cheating.
Okay, all right, let's make it cheating.
Yeah, so no, you can't use like the fact that this is the same word as another word.
Okay, yep.
And use that disambiguation link.
I dig, yep.
Although that's smart, and you might get half credit if you do that.
Okay, half credit.
Cool, so test-driven development to sardines. Good luck.
Yep.
Anyway, back to your issue. You have end-to-end issues.
Right. So basically, talking to Keith Sage, and we sunk our teeth into the problem. And basically, it's like you have to, it is an end. So, I mean, I personally think it should be in the dust test. I want it to be in the dust test, which is crazy that I was saying that like I'm creating an entity on a UI form, and then I'm asserting that like a specific set of JSON exists in a separate endpoint, you know, like in a separate database thing. So But that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I ended up doing. And so now there's this problem of, like, do you store a fixture, like a testing fixture that's like, I like, here is a set of JSON that this response needs to abide by, you know? Like I open this form in Dusk, I type in test dummy as the name, I type in, you know, happy place as the address, and then I check in the NoSQL database that there is an entry with test dummy name and, right? Yep, tracking.
Yep.
So do you store that check thing as a fixture, like a JSON fixture, and then check the NoSQL response against that fixture? So mm-hmm. that's what I would initially think to do. But the problem with that is I've now, one of my like least favorite things in life is maintaining fixtures, because it sucks.
Sure.
And you have them in so many places. And so I would have this fixture for my Dust tests. I would have a different fixture for like integration tests. And the same fixture would exist on four other microservices. And when you want to add a field, everything's crazy. And it's just, I don't know, whatever.
It's so, insanity.
Yeah. So I started looking into snapshot testing. So enter snapshot testing. What is snapshot testing? Do you know snapshot testing and can explain it?
Yeah, so basically it's like you get an API response and you take a snapshot of it.
Yeah, so in this case, it's that. I've heard of other forms. Apparently, it's just kind of a broad term. Like you can do snapshot, you can do actual physical, like take a picture of this page and then check against like pixel by pixel other images, you know, when you run the test against. That's like actual snapshot testing, like image snapshot. And then I think there's other snapshot testing, what Sam is kind of about to drop, this crazy awesome stuff. Should I not say anything about that form of snapshot testing?
We'll talk about it after her blog post, but her blog post is cool.
Another cool form of snapshot testing that's going to be really sweet and super useful and awesome for full stack Vue Laravel people. And that's a whole other thing. So yeah, so in my case, and so of course Spotsy has a snapshot, PHP snapshot testing, PHP unit snapshot thing. And this is Frank, kind of, man, along the lines.
Always with the packages.
Yeah.
Always got one.
Freaking it. So yeah, so I pulled that in. This is kind of like PHP VCR, except it's a little different.
Yeah.
But it's, I've used that. Same kind
you
of deal.
You made me use that once.
Yeah, right. Same kind of deal. But basically, yeah, so you just now, so basically with this, I get to eliminate the need for me to maintain fixtures. It just generates a fixture for me and then checks against the fixture, right?
Sure.
So that's a win. So now I can go to a UI and say, type this name, type this address, hit save, see that the page has those things, and then check against the NoSQL database. Well, all I do is like snapshot, assert snapshot or whatever, and it does it for me. It hits the database mm-hmm. and it checks against the stored snapshot. Sound good?
Yes.
And then, all right, so here's a couple things. What if, so you're in your testing environment, you can't destroy a database and rebuild it. What if you're working on a QA database or something, right?
Okay.
You have different IDs for these tests. Each entity you make has a different ID. So now your snapshot breaks.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, so that was hurdle number one.
Uh-huh.
So
why are you working on a QA database?
Oh, well, we're not going to go there. You know what?
Okay.
You don't understand with microservices, Daniel. You can't just.
I guess I don't.
You can't just. You can't just use migrations.
Change an environment variable. Yeah.
It's not how it works. This is the real world.
Okay.
These people went to AWS Summit.
Went to college. Yeah.
So yeah. So in the real world, you can't do that. So IDs differ. Timestamps differ. Stuff like that. So basically I found this cool package, a coworker recommended it to me. It's called TreeWalker, where you basically hand it two arrays or two JSON sets and it gets you the diff, in a nice, like,
okay,
array. So it gives you like a new changed and removed thing and populates it.
Okay.
So I use TreeWalker to like basically check the diffs, and if the keys are like ID or timestamp, ignore them. Remove them from the diff.
Okay.
So basically ignoring specific like timestamps and IDs. And so that is that. That's up until then. So even that just itself is pretty useful.
Yeah.
Another problem. Uh-huh. What if person X adds a new feature that adds a new field or changes something to the NoSQL?
Right.
Right.
Now it's all out of whack.
Now it's all out of whack. So what do you do as person X who wants to pull request your new code, but all the tests are failing because your snapshots are old? You wipe out the snapshots and regenerate uh-huh. them. And then uh-huh. you get the test to pass. Perfect in a perfect world, but if you introduce a regression in that pull request accidentally somewhere else in the system, you've regenerated the whole snapshot and you didn't catch it, and now all your tests are giving you false positives.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So do you run the tests first and then generate the snapshot and then rerun the tests? What are you doing?
Right. Well, no matter how you do it, you can you run the there's the possibility of introducing a regression in the system because you're wiping out a snapshot and completely rebuilding it, you know?
Can you give me an example of how that would happen?
Okay. So I am introducing a feature. My task is to add country to the profile, to a user profile.
Sure.
Okay. So right now my dusk test is visit the UI, type in name, something else, see that the stuff's in Elasticsearch, it all passes. So then I write the code that adds in country, the country field on the front end, the country field in the NoSQL database, the country, right, all throughout the app.
Right.
Yep.
Right, right.
Then I go to do my dusk test. It says it fails because, you know, because I need to add testing for my country code. Let's say it's like country code field is required. So in my dusk test, uh-huh. I then add something that says type country into country field, right? And then uh-huh. in my, so then I run the test and it fails and it says snapshot doesn't match. We're expecting just name and address, but what we got was name, address, and country.
Right.
Right. So then I would say, I would look at that and I would go, okay, I need to wipe out the snapshot and then run it again so it stores the new snapshot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's say when I was adding this country field, I accidentally wrote it in such a way that I opened it up so that any field you added, like I didn't use request only, let's say I used request all, and like
mm-hmm.
any field you added went all the way to NoSQL. And like what you could wipe out fields or something. I don't know. Something. Let's say
sure.
You know, it wiped out. I added something that allowed it to wipe out something in NoSQL. So right. then when you run the test again,
it's taking a snapshot of a bad state now.
Exactly.
And then it's matching it.
Exactly.
And then, oh, okay. Now I see what you're saying. Yes.
Right. So anyway, that's kind of okay. a long story to say that like that is a limitation of snapshot testing. And the best thing we came up with was like putting in a process so that you have to diff the master branch and what you're about to deploy, check for the snapshot files, and get the developer to like sign off that all of these are just the changes that they want to be made, you know?
Huh. That's not fun.
It's not, but it's actually, I think it's way better than maintaining fixtures everywhere, you know?
Yeah. No, it's probably the right thing to do.
But, you know, I don't know. Even as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, like, is it? But I really like the idea of snapshot testing because it's so flexible and so, like, reliable, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's so reliable. It's not, it's, I don't know. There's something that feels so right about it to me that it'll catch things that my normal assertions and fixtures and stuff wouldn't catch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so we did a bunch of snapshot testing on like a API consumer we built that basically like pulled down a bunch of WordPress posts from some WordPress JSON API.
Okay.
And like did a bunch of stuff with it. And so we basically had like a snapshot, a manually maintained snapshot of the WordPress JSON, right? And like we just fed that into the consumer and then like asserted a bunch of stuff.
Right.
Which is good and all, except that like that changes and then everything changes and then everything's right. broken.
Yep.
And so I don't know. To me it feels like doing it your way, it really depends on the structure of your organization, dude. It's like more of a political thing than a technical thing, I think.
Really?
Because you have to decide who you're gonna inconvenience, right?
Okay.
So like yep. by having someone like have to sign off on the changes to the snapshot or whatever,
mm-hmm.
like that to me feels like, okay, like what if that person signs off on the wrong thing? You know, it's like, who do you trust? Who do you inconvenience? Yep. Like who's,
yep.
like if these snapshots affect everyone and someone changes the snapshot wrong, like it seems like those need to be code reviewed, you know, the changes to the snapshot. So like if those are code reviewed, then like basically now you're inconveniencing like the direct manager there.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a question of like, are these snapshots global? Like are people from all the different services dealing with these snapshots? Like, you know what I'm saying? Because like if someone changes something here versus someone changes something there, but they all affect the snapshot.
Right.
Like, where are these snapshots stored? Who's responsible for them? Whose job is it to deal with them?
Well, as it stands, it'd be stored with the dusk tests. So like it would be that guy's job to like fix it when it's broken, but he would.
So what if someone else breaks it though?
Right. It would be his responsibility to find out like who did it. And I see what you're saying. So
it's a hard problem.
The person who introduces the problem could be in a different system in a different repository, and you just and so there would never be a commit to blame.
Well, unless you have access to their repo as well.
But when you see the difference, it wouldn't be like, oh, the snapshot is changed along with. Wait a second.
This is not good. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I think it might not matter because, all right, let's say I'm the person responsible for maintaining the snapshots and the acceptance tests with Dusk, okay?
Yes.
And I'm in that system. Somebody, and everything's passing, everything's green, everything's good. Somebody in a different system, you know, adds a feature and it gets all the way up to production. Or not all the way up to production, because this suite has to be run before it gets to production, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So they introduce this feature, the test suite gets run because it has to be run before you like push it to each next level in the deployment, and it gets run and it's red. And then you look at why it's red and you go, oh, this is wrong. And then you tell somebody. Right?
Yeah, but that's kind of what I'm saying is like, yeah, but like only people who have access to the code base that includes the Dusk tests can fix it when it's red, is what I'm saying.
Right, but the thing is you wouldn't fix it when it's red. You would fix the problem, right? If you, I guess what I'm saying.
Say someone else somewhere down the line needed to introduce a new field, you know?
Right, okay, and it didn't impact, right, and then you would have to, yeah.
But if it messes up your snapshot.
Right, the snapshot would be red. But that person would say, hey, I'm getting like snapshot failures, or I would say, hey, I'm getting snapshot failures. I would look at the difference and I would communicate with that person.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. It's like that's now, the overhead, right? Like, right, that's what I meant by like it's more political than it is technical. Like now it's like, okay, well, like what if those two teams work for different companies?
The same problem exists if you use fixtures, though. Same exact thing.
Yeah, okay. I think this all needs to live in like some, I think the only way to do this, and like this, you tell me, cause you're like Mr. Microservices right now, but like, I think the only way to do this is to have the tests be a separate service.
Oh, we went
like,
down that road.
Literally.
Yeah.
All like acceptance integration tests, like all like end to end tests are a separate service that every team has access to.
Right. So that was something that I entertained and thought long and hard about it, and that may be an eventuality. The problem with that, so like right now you get to leverage certain things with Dusk. Like you get to leverage authentication. So Dusk has that like login as stuff.
Yeah.
Right. But you know what? That doesn't even matter because, well, it kind of does. Yeah, it does matter. It does matter. Yep. So right now with Dusk, because of Dusk's cool way of like niftily being able to modify session stuff and authentication stuff on the object that it's testing, when you separate that out, you don't get that benefit, you know?
Right.
So you don't get that deep control of being able to manipulate. Now it's a different type of acceptance testing. Like Dusk is sort of a middle ground. Like there are different acceptance testing suites that are meant for sort of really outside in testing and they wouldn't modify anything about a system, but Dusk is kind of intertwined. There's that view stuff, there's session stuff, there's log, you know, there's authentication stuff. There's lots of stuff that it does, you know? I mean, you can, yeah.
So in a perfect world, I think in a perfect world, you need to have a test suite that tests every API from a central location and maintains snapshots for all of the APIs.
Right, just like a snapshot tester for...
in a central location.
Right. So the problem is getting those APIs, calling on those APIs, you would need fixtures to call on them. You know?
Why?
So what if it was a creation API where you had to submit a certain set of data?
Uh-huh.
You would have to submit that data from that system, you know? Like that central testing system would have to know the data to submit to an API to then assert a snapshot response.
Right.
So it would have knowledge of like what APIs need, you know?
Is there any way to get that from Apiary? You're using Apiary, right?
Sort of, not really on this part, but I am kind of, yeah.
So theoretically, if everyone's API was an Apiary, you could probably pull data out of Apiary somehow.
Yeah, the problem, you could, yeah. Yeah. Apiary kind of broke down for me with the whole like mock endpoint thing because you can't, there's no conditions, you know, you can't like say if I create this thing with this field, I get this response. You can't specify what will trigger a 400. And so you can't test validation unless you pass like a custom header that says, give me back validation errors.
This is such a hard problem, man. And like Adam's talked a lot about like how to test like other people's code and stuff and like how to isolate it and just test like up into the point of other people's code. And mm-hmm. I think like we're all pretty relatively good at that.
Right.
But like when it's microservices, dude, it's like you have like some responsibility for the code, even though it's not, like not technically you, it's like someone else.
That but is like, where, yeah, it's this whole, and you're tiptoeing.
It gets complicated when it's like, it's not my code, but it's like that guy over there's code, but I can't spend my entire life sitting on that guy's shoulder telling him to make his code better. You
totally.
Know?
And the more in that paradigm, like, so we should be developing in such a way that every microservice doesn't trust any other service just as much as you don't trust a third party API that you use in your monolith app, you know? So like you should test up to that point, and there's these clear boundaries and everything is filtered and sanitized and validated and everything, you know, and you don't have any real integration testing. When you do that, like, I guess you could have real integration testing, but nothing that is able to interact with another service, you know? When you get to that level, like the problem is that the cost is so huge that I find that it's rare that people get to that level, and I don't want to get to that level. But then when stuff breaks, like then everybody goes, we need clear boundaries, you know, and then all the walls go up and all the cost goes up on maintaining these services. Then the overhead of those the walls between those services is so much that it slows everything down so much, which is why microservices are super costly. So yeah, because they wouldn't be as costly if you trusted them. If it was like, oh yeah, I work on these three services, I don't need to like go nuts with you know what I'm saying? You could just
I like that. I like that as kind of the thesis of the last 6 months of Caleb Porzio's life. Microservices are very costly. They wouldn't be so costly if you trusted them. I think that's like a pretty good like lesson learned from like the last however long you've been on this project.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thesis statement is microservices are costly. Yeah, partially because you can't trust them, because if you do trust them and then something breaks, then everybody freaks out and you have to then trust them or not trust them.
I think
them.
You have gained a lot of wisdom on this project.
I agree. I think like definitely it's been way and... it's been way outside of my comfort zone in scale, in variety of languages and technologies and disciplines and people and everything. Yeah.
Your perspective has definitely changed. Like from when we started this podcast to now, I think the primary driver of like the change in like the mindset and attitudes of Caleb Porzio towards programming has been like... the discovering that microservices are costly.
Yeah, definitely.
And like all of the like measured consideration that goes along with that, right? Because like now it's so much less like you with this type of architecture, it's so not the case that you can have like very exciting hardline opinions that you just enforce 100% of the time.
Oh my gosh,
because
it's
always going to break something somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
This is very interesting.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed watching your development.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah. So,
well, okay, so here's the deal. So Jake Bathman predicts that the first episode that goes over an hour will be number 41, and I don't want to disappoint him. So we've got 10 minutes to wrap this thing up before it becomes an hour long.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I feel like it was another really good one, though. Like, I mean, we covered, like, a lot in...
Yeah, we got a lot. We had jokes. We had yucks.
We did, yeah,
we
right.
had we had food database, home automation, neural networks, machine learning.
But we didn't talk about
microservices,
VS Code extensions. That's a
no. We didn't.
That's a whole
maybe
other
next week.
Thing. Whole other
maybe
thing.
Maybe next week.
I want to talk.
I
about
I see you're
that.
Doing it. All right. Can you do it in 6 minutes?
Yes.
All right.
Six
go.
6 minutes, Slim Shady. You're on.
Go.
So, 6 minutes. VS Code extension. Okay, VS Code, you write an extension. It's in JavaScript, which is awesome. To test your extension, like not automated test, but to actually run the extension that you're building that's not published yet, VS Code, when you go to the debug thing, you know in VS Code when you go to like run the like xdebug?
Yes.
The play button? You literally, when
yes.
you're developing an extension... You go to that play button and it just says launch extension and it creates like a sandbox VS Code for you to use your extension in.
That's nice.
Yeah. And it's actually like the output, the console output is connected to the like the mother editor and it like output gets logged in the mother editor so you can look at like things that are going wrong in your sandbox editor. So I've been writing this extension and I'm just manually testing it, you know, because I wouldn't even know how to start automated testing something like this. And so eventually, like, I got to this point where the extension is not huge, but I want to do lots of refactorings. And I it's fairly active on GitHub, like enough that I am getting a decent stream of issues and pull requests. And so when I get those, like, it's that problem is like, I want to pull in your code. But I have no way to know it works, and it's going to take me so long to go through all the edge cases, and I feel like I'm going to miss something, and then I'm going to ruin everybody's day by like pushing out a broken release, you know?
Yes.
So that's where things are at. Pause. Ziggy. Have you experienced that with Ziggy? Is Ziggy well-tested? You have confidence in it? Automated testing?
Well, yes and no. Yes. Yes. Very much so, yes.
Okay.
I do have good tests. I discovered the other day... that Travis was only running half of them.
Oh boy.
And so I merged some PRs that broke tests and I didn't realize it. Thankfully I didn't tag a release.
Nice.
But yeah, somewhere down the line, I gotta go get blame this. I probably did it. But somewhere down the line I switched from CodeShip to Travis. And at some point Travis did run PHP unit. But like I only have like 4 PHP tests. You know,
okay.
It's mostly JavaScript tests.
Right, right.
Oh. And I haven't like changed the PHP in like a long time, but someone somewhere PR'd something that broke one of the PHP unit tests. And when I did something, I changed the Travis YAML file and somehow I removed PHP unit from it. So it was only running the NPM tests.
Wow.
What's this
and
guy's
the
name?
NPM
Anchor...
tests are just like unit tests, right? The PHP
yeah.
unit tests are the actual like integration like of with Laravel and routes and stuff.
Right. And it was like it wasn't bad. Like the code still worked.
Yeah.
They just hadn't updated the tests to reflect the new way they did things.
Gotcha. Okay.
But yeah, anyway, there's this Anchor 91 is one of like the chief contributors to to Ziggy.
Okay.
And is a awesome dude. He basically like added PHP unit back to Travis in a pull request and everything failed. I was like, oh no, like what has happened? But it turned out that all the code actually still worked. We just needed to fix the tests.
Wow.
But yes, now we have a well-tested product.
Nice.
That we are shipping.
Yeah, no, I've definitely been there. I'm kind of there right now on a project that's yeah. Okay. Heard. So, yeah, so getting to that point is definitely a big win, and I'm like, how do I get to that point with this? I can unit test, but how do I even unit test? Because most of it is interacting with the, like, you get this VS Code object that allows
you.
You want
Dusk for VS Code.
Exactly. I need Dusk for VS Code. I mean, it's weird because you get this VS Code object in when you write your extension, and that's what you do everything with. You execute commands with that. You register commands. You do everything with that. So it's like, yep. What am I going to mock out this VS Code object? Mock out all of these like specific methods, and what is that going to do for me? Probably nothing if I even do anything useful with it. And so I'm like, I would just love an acceptance thing. How do I even start with that? And so apparently, like, VS Code kind of magically works where when you go to do that debug thing and you say launch, so back up, VS Code comes stock with a test file that's a Mocha test. And it just, all it does is it makes like an assertion that 1 + 1 = 2, you know, like I looked at it immediately and I was like, okay, so this is all unit testing. This doesn't help me at all. So what you can do when you go to debug, like xdebug or launch in the extension, there's a drop down and you can say test extension, and it opens a snapshot, or it opens a, you know, a sandbox editor, and it runs through your test suite and then it closes it when it finishes. So basically, I guess the story is you can't really assert stuff. There's no like assert terminal is open, you know, like there's no assert terminal output. And you can't screen scrape or anything like that. So what I did was I like packed everything I could pack into an object, a JavaScript object that exposed a few key things, like the file the test file that's being run, the test method that's being run, the command, the full command, the URL to the PHP unit binary, you know, so like all the basic things, so that the extension code itself, like the extension file, is pretty much like, build up this object.
And then that object generates the terminal output and all of
that. Exactly. So all it is like VS Code dot, essentially, in theory, it's like...
So you're just testing that object and then you're trusting that like
so,
it gets
yeah,
to the terminal.
So like in the test, I do stuff because in the test file, I can say like VS Code, open this file. And then I can say go to line 12. And I have fixtures for all my different PHP files. And so it's all like hard coded, like line 12 is in a method, test method that fails, you know, and I can say like, go to that thing, hit this key combination, and then assert that this object, this JavaScript object, has this property, you know. So it's kind of like snapshot testing, kind of not really, in the sense that I am a lot of times testing against the full command that gets run. I don't know if you grok that, but it's like not a full... It was my own way of like, what if I punched a hole in my extension and exposed the object that stores all the state
to my test
file? I do
that all the time, everywhere. Really? I do that in like almost every code base I've ever done.
For JavaScript, or for
all sorts of stuff. But like just the principle of like, so this is the thing, like, and like this is, so ever since I've been using, this might break an hour, who cares? Ever since I've been using VS Code, speaking of which, I use your extension like 1,000 times a day. It's amazing.
Sweet.
The KP is like my whole life.
KP.
Command K, command P.
You kept it. Yeah. Jeffrey, when he released that video, he made it command T and command shift T. Immediately I was like, oh dang, like I got to do that. But that
no,
messes me
I like, up. No, I like the KRKP.
Cool.
Run and previous. It makes total
sense.
Oh,
wow. Look at you.
Yeah.
That's so good to hear.
That I understood your keyboard shortcuts?
Yeah.
It makes total sense.
Oh, that's so great.
Anyway, Jeffrey. Come on, Jeffrey. Jeff. Just trust Caleb a little bit sometimes. He probably uses those for other things. I don't know. Anyway, I love it. But yeah, the concept of like, so ever since I've been using VS Code and using xdebug, I find myself creating more temporary variables.
To get the extra line in xdebug?
To get the extra line.
Me too.
So that you can just check the status of that variable watch it. Right? It's like, and this is the thing, is like, I think both you and I, like in the old world where we dumped things, you would just dump the thing that was going to be in the variable.
Right.
Or you could like store it in a temporary variable, dump it. And then once you realized it was the right thing, you could put it back out, like not in a temporary variable.
Yeah, totally.
But this is the thing, is like with xdebug, like I want temporary variables a lot more because like watching them is so useful.
Yep.
And it makes your code like a little uglier.
Well, you can
but
watch
not, like,
expressions, but you'd have to like type,
can you
type? Yeah, you can watch expressions. Yeah,
that's very cool. I should do that.
It is pretty cool. Yeah,
haven't been doing that. But anyway, temporary variables, like, it's just nice. I just love that. And so this is a thing I've done for a long time is like, sometimes I'll just like create, like in a perfect world, if I wasn't testing something, like I wouldn't create like a break here, you know, like I would just take it from like da 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 da, da, da and then like the return, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But like sometimes when I'm testing, like I'm like, okay, well, what if I like wrap that thing up in an object so I could just test that object and not have to worry about like testing like this really awkward like integration test when I could just like real quick like unit test that object, right. You know? And like I do that more than you would think. Like I often make architecture decisions based on like what test, like because it's like test driven development, right? I very rarely like write like this big complicated test where or like even the like super simple test where I'm like, you know, hit API endpoint, assert that this exists in database.
Right.
You know, yep. I rarely write those as like my first test. I often am like, okay, what is like the essential like input and output that I want? Okay. Now, like, can I create an object that like takes that input and gives me that output?
Interesting.
You know,
yeah.
Because it's so much easier to just like say like, or even just a function, you know,
right.
That does that. But it's like, it's so much easier to just test that, like, given these two inputs, it gives me this one output.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep, definitely.
And then, like, all the stuff that, like, connects to that, like, yeah, like, I don't need to test that, like, you know, that, like, array shift does array shift, you know?
Right, right.
Or, like, that's a terrible example. But, like, you know, I don't need to test that, that like, you know, an API returning JSON returns JSON, you know? Or whatever. Like,
right,
that's
right.
Not
yeah, yeah.
Really
no,
my
I
business
get you.
Logic.
Yeah.
And like,
yep.
I probably will end up testing the API later just for regression purposes.
Right.
But like, when I'm actually doing like test-driven development, like, I don't care about all of that stuff as much. What I care about is like, what are the inputs? What are the outputs?
Yeah.
Do those work?
Right, I hear you.
Then the business logic works, you know?
Right. The sacrifice is that like, and you're describing my case exactly. I think the same problem exists there is that like, you have, there's two problems there. The first problem is that you've changed your architecture for your test, which I'm sure most people would say that's not a problem at all. But like, I literally, the only reason I structured like this object this specific way was so that I could test it, you know, in my MoCA test. So I'm deliberately like making an architecture decision for my test. So I'm like a part of that part like gives me like the willies a little bit. And then the other thing is that there's that little gap. There's that gap between the object and then it actually being fired as a command in VS Code. Now, what that relies on is that, like you're saying that, well, yeah, because array shift does array shift and JSON, you know, I know those things do those things. And so in my case, it's like, I know VS Code dot execute command. And then you put in the command. I know it does that thing, you know,
yeah,
like I
know
I don't
it
have
executes
to test
a command.
That. But right. That is a file in my code that could change and some things could, you know, whatever. So it is a point of like, it is a gap there that before it wouldn't exist in a perfect like acceptance end-to-end test, you know? So I don't even know if I can call
and, like,
it an acceptance test.
It matters so much more in open source too. Like this is the thing I've learned from Ziggy is like tests I would write in code bases where it was like me and Samantha were the ones writing code or like me and Matt were the ones writing code. Those tests are not good enough for open source. Like, you like in open source you have to test things that are like
right. Yeah,
really
yeah.
Really obvious
definitely
because it's like people open PRs and they break stuff and they don't run the tests
right.
And then it's that it's your thing
yep,
you know
exactly.
Your repo's the one that's broken
yep
you know
yep.
So like just to save yourself from the headache like and like so Ziggy the way Ziggy is architected is 100% because of testing. It's like I built like a whole JavaScript like I have a whole .js file that like runs independent that like could run independently as like an ES6 module and
okay.
I just literally like import that into PHP as a string.
Wow. Right, right. I remember you telling me about that.
But like I had to have it as a separate JS file so that I could write MoCA tests because
right.
I was like I can't not test this JavaScript because people are breaking it like every pull request.
Right. That is so interesting. That yeah, the I was going to say the interesting thing here and I think this is similar but it's different on one end, and I'm interested. Okay, so what you're saying is, you know, you have end to end, but if you just take out the ends and you just create your own ends, with an object or whatever, then you can create them more deliberately and it will take less time and, you know, things like that, right? You're
well, and it's also like kind of like what we were talking about earlier, like don't test other people's code, right? And like sometimes other people's code is just like that PHP is PHP.
Oh, right. Or that right? Laravel is like, Laravel, or that VS Code
or that VS Code is VS Code.
SDK
right.
is VS Code, extension SDK, library, whatever.
Right. And so it's like you can pull those boundaries in a little bit and say like, hey, like
yeah,
these tests are going to be like way more fragile or B, way more complicated
right.
if I worry about testing that like
right.
returning an eloquent object from an API endpoint returns that eloquent object from the API endpoint as JSON.
The
right?
thing is, like in my case, it's not like you could in theory, yeah, like let's say you pull it in a little like you're saying and you test input against output. And if it's functional, like then it's like, yeah, you're in a closed way. You're testing these things. In my case, the input is actually manipulating the VS Code editor, and it could be affected by so many things. It could be affected by you not having the right version of PHP on your Mac. You know, like mm-hmm. so that's the interesting thing about it to me is that the input I give to it is like, click this thing, hit these buttons in the editor, but my assertions are against an actual JavaScript object, like literally the JavaScript. And that was my first hurdle, was like, is that even possible? Can I like reach mm-hmm. into the plugin and get a JavaScript object that's actually being manipulated by a sandbox editor? You know, like how do JavaScript objects work? Can I like pull this by reference and actually like get not just get
yeah,
a copy
it's
of?
Electron, right? So yeah, it's just a big DOM.
Yeah.
Basically, right? So well, that object exists on the window or whatever, or on the document.
No, it doesn't. It's,
it
yeah,
doesn't?
Well, I guess somehow, but it's not, no, it's not like that, no.
But it's like a sub-object of something else.
Something somewhere, but because it's all JavaScript, yeah. It has to be JavaScript somewhere, so yeah. Mm-hmm. But I was like, how do you do that? If I have a separate module for this JavaScript that I import in my extension, and then in my test, if I import that same module, will it be by reference? Will it track the changes that are happening to the instance of the other import? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. That's not the case. You have to do something. I don't know. I don't remember, but it's possible.
You have to make singletons in
exactly.
JavaScript.
I'm like, how do I? Okay, I need a singleton. I'm like, I need to make a singleton in JavaScript. How do you make a singleton in JavaScript? And you can, but there is a better way. There is an easier way that's not a singleton. It's just like, it just works.
I think you just assign it to a variable, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, no, for real, yeah. It is like, yeah.
No, I know.
Yeah, it's something global.
All right, anyway, let's wrap this up. This is a great, great, great episode.
Oh, man, yeah. So was that 6 minutes? Yeah, it was.
Hour and 7 minutes, yeah.
Okay.
So take that, Jake Bathman. Try to predict what we're going to do.
Jake Bathman, never again will he predict what we're going to do.
Well, his code is predicting. So I guess now I want to see if it causes an error when we break an hour. I want to see if his page errors out.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, we should see.
This is interesting because it says first greater than 1 hour episode estimated. So what happens when there is a greater than 1 hour episode?
Yeah, we're going to break it.
Oh. I wonder if he wrote a condition for that.
We'll see.
Let's see how smart this Jake Bathman guy really is.
This Jake Bathman character.
All right,
bud.
All right, good episode, sir.
Good times. Good times.
And a big shout out to Jared White for providing this music.